Hi, this is Paul Verge, director of the interview you're about to hear, which is actually just the audio taken from the video version of the interview. There are a ton of visuals, documents, quotes, and other references in the video that prove to be very interesting, but for purposes of this podcast and our bandwidth allocations, we're just publishing the audio herein. If you'd like to screen the entire film, you can search YouTube under the search terms 2020 Hindsight, Censorship on the Front Line, or Wall Street Whistleblower Proves That Money Never Sleeps. Either one should pull up the playlist for the 9 parts on YouTube. And if you'd like to order the DVD, the links are in the description on the YouTube page for each video. The DVD includes several bonus features and a DVD-ROM feature that makes it a great tool through which you can communicate with others. I'd like to thank TragedyandHope.com and Peace Revolution for making this project possible. And thank you for listening. Now, let's get to the interview in its entirety. Enjoy.
Named. I don't have them all at my command.
Well, how can you propose to solve the problems of the company that you're now running if you don't know the names of the people who caused that problem?
Because there are great people running AIG.
White-collar crime seems to have become part of our status quo. As new scandals sprout to the surface almost daily, the constant confusion creates a citizenry desensitized to corporate crime, and most people can't even fathom the frauds, let alone resolve the cognitive dissonance created by the frauds.
I'm just not going to do that, sir, because that will provide, that could be a list of people that we could do some. Individuals who want to do damage to them could do that.
Well, listen, these same people could now be working right now, today, at Citibank. Is it more important to protect them, the ones who caused the $100 billion loss, or protect us? Which is more important to you right now?
The important thing is to protect both. I'm just not going to sit here and give it to you until I understand what the implications are.
Can I count on you to give us that list? Yes or no?
I do not know. I will consult with our general counsel and decide what the appropriate course of action is.
Not the answer I was hoping for, but my time is up.
The criminals have become accustomed to refusing congressional inquiries and expert at bending and bribing our representatives to their will, now with the approval of the Supreme Court. But that's only because we, the people, have been kept in the dark as to how this all perpetuates. Tonight, we shed some light by presenting a story censored by the establishment media and relevant to anyone who uses money, plans for the future, and is aware enough to listen and consider the views expressed by our guest, a Wall Street whistleblower whose experiences illustrate how the legislation implemented by Congress, which should have been a protective measure against fraud, actually favored rogue financial services companies and was used as a weapon of fraud against the people. And today, many trillions of dollars are still unaccounted for. We begin with the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002, the law created as a strategic solution to reduce white-collar crime and to address a number of major corporate and accounting scandals, including those infecting Enron, Tyco International, WorldCom, and many others. This is an interview which demonstrates the gross negligence of the regulatory agencies, courts, and media outlets, whose actions indicate that it's more important to protect the frauds and ensure the rights of rogue corporations than to serve your interests and preserve the public trust. This is also the story of a corporate account executive who blew the whistle under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, who warned the SEC in 2003, and who was subsequently retaliated against, terminated, and blacklisted, whereupon he brought a multi-billion dollar corporation into court, leveraging the alleged protections granted to whistleblowers under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. Among his clients were AIG, J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, Tyco International, WorldCom, Northrop Grumman, and DynCorp, among other government contractors and notorious global financial institutions. And what he discovered was a backdoor in the Sarbanes-Oxley compliance software which he was tasked to sell these companies, and that the law was being employed by executives to further obscure frauds from public scrutiny. After reading more than 1,000 pages of court transcripts related to this case, Vancouver-based documentary filmmaker Paul Verge flew to Connecticut to interview this whistleblower and shed some much-needed light on these events. The result is what follows, an enlightening and empowering perspective which dampens confusion and stimulates understanding. This interview was conducted on December 10th, 2009, and is entitled 2020 Hindsight, Censorship on the Front Line.
Well, how, in your experience, are massive frauds like the Bernie Madoff scandal, for instance, successfully perpetrated outside of our awareness?
The fraud is perpetrated, and you know this from the news, and you see the evidence in the news. So what you have is people who have known about this fraud, the whistleblowers, have done their job. They've gone to court, they've collected their evidence, they've gone to the media, and where the ball's being dropped is the Fourth Estate is not publishing this information. So in the case of the Madoff scandal, there was a guy named Harry Markopoulos who came forward to the SEC and said, Madoff's running a scam. And the SEC chose not to enforce on that scam, thus allowing the scam to be perpetrated and everyone getting taken advantage of. So it's a failure of the Fourth Estate to carry forward the information and evidence from whistleblowers and get that information to the public, the investors, the people who own those companies, et cetera, who are probably unwitting and in the dark to most of it.
What do whistleblowers like yourself actually encounter when they finally decide to blow the whistle?
The way it works is that if you're a whistleblower, you're reaching out to what you feel are credible entities that were going to take this information, research it, validate it, and present it to the public in a coherent manner such that people can understand that which you're blowing the whistle and risking your career on. And what you find is that many news agencies simply aren't interested. They say our readers aren't interested, when in fact it just means it's a conflict of interest with their advertising. Other agencies will take your information and look at it only to tell us later that, well, we can't print this even though it's interesting. It's just not something that we can go ahead with. Again, it's a conflict of interest between the people who are actually funding those media entities and the whistleblowers who are coming forward with this information and trying to get it out to people, and not understanding that many of these news agencies were built specifically by other corporations in order to manage news effectively, to edit news, to suppress news, to censor news, to make sure that whistleblower testimony does not get out to the public. And when that Fourth Estate that is supposed to be there watching the government and reporting back to the people and empowering us such that we can get ourselves around this information and have the context to make informed choices in our lives, that breakdown is essential to be known to the public, because once you understand the Fourth Estate is broken down, you'll start to look at some of this stuff for yourself and you'll start to see that what they're telling you on the news is not only contradictory and misleading, but it's outright aiding and abetting the frauds that are in progress, because a lot of these news agencies will suppress and sit on whistleblower information that, if circulated, would stop those frauds in progress and send out a warning to everybody to become aware that there are people out there doing X, Y, and Z, and this is some sort of Ponzi scheme that Madoff had, for instance, and they would become aware and they would move their money, and that would mean the people running the fraud would make a lot less money. So when you have not only journalists, but probably, you know, the protection agencies that are in on keeping a lid on these frauds so that the people doing it can perpetrate it fully to its full maturity and not get caught in its adolescence and have it blow up in their faces. By the time you find out about Madoff, he's already stolen billions from tens of thousands of people potentially, and it's already gone and no one knows where the money's at. And it's just another example of how the Fourth Estate could have done their job, but they chose not to, and how the enforcement agencies are more likely to protect the corporations doing these types of frauds than they are the public interest. And I just thought people should know after figuring all of this out, this is the only way to get it out.
If your evidence and whistleblower testimony were published by Frontline in 2004, would the Madoff scandal have been possible?
No, because for it to have been possible, the American people would have had to forget facts that they have already had presented in front of them, which made them understand that this giant fraud was taking place on mammoth, like enormous Leviathan-like levels that were taking over all these corporations through broad spectrum regulations put out there to protect the markets, when really it was empowering corporations to circumvent the markets and have nobody find out until after the damage is done. So the short answer is no, because the public would have to forget what they knew in order for it to happen.
What about the AIG fraud, the nationalization of numerous companies, and all of the bailouts?
had the public become aware that the SEC was no longer protecting the integrity of the markets as its mandate appears to be, when you see that those actions conflict with the mandate and you see that there's no integrity with the markets and that the watchdogs that are actually supposed to protect us and public interest in our investments and our retirement accounts are actually out to lunch on the take and protecting these frauds that are in place to steal billions and trillions of dollars, then you look at the bailouts and the AIGs and the General Motors and all these different 2008, 2009, going into 2010 kind of corporations that are all getting helped along instead of, you know, capitalism says if you can't survive, then you go extinct. And it doesn't tell you that you're supposed to get bailed out by the government. And when you see that these things are contrived and then you see that all these honest, hardworking people are getting their money stolen, they're getting their life's work stolen, they're getting their retirement stolen, they're getting their kids' futures stolen. And your news agencies that are supposed to report about these things are, you know, they're out to lunch is the politest term that I can give it, but really, in effect, they are derelict in their duty, and they have betrayed the responsibility, and they've betrayed the trust of their audiences. So I can't understand why the American people are still subscribing to the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and these other magazines and publications that are completely taking away any integrity or any context of the story that would allow you to actually get out of the fraud. Their job is to keep you in front of the fraud all the time so that these frauds can continue to perpetrate. And in the case of AIG, I mean, their actions in the past couple years are just the end result of what they've been doing for the past decade. And when you look into AIG's origins as the American International Company back in 1919 doing business out of China, there's a lot of interesting history with AIG that ties not only into the OSS and the CIA, it ties into 9/11, it ties into Elliott Spitzer and all sorts of other things. So they really don't want you to look into who got the bonuses at AIG, where that money went, how they paid off foreign banks with U.S. taxpayer money, and all this other sort of shenanigans that have gone on in the absence of a critical thinking media source covering events in America.
What exactly did your experiences lead you to realize?
It led me to realize that the agencies and organizations that are tasked with oversight in our American markets, in our United States financial markets, are at best helping to cover up the frauds that we're just now beginning to realize in progress. At worst, they're helping these guys to perpetrate these frauds, that the media is not responsible and cannot be trusted to report to the public on these frauds, and that the summation of all of this leads to the public having giant blind spots in their awareness wherein these frauds can be perpetrated, people can be preyed on, and the money's gone. And when you go to an authority like the SEC and say, I have witnessed fraud, I have evidence of fraud, here it is, and they're not interested in it, it's an early warning system. It's a type of protection racket. And when you blow the whistle as a corporate employee, whether it's to the general counsel of your company or you're going directly to the SEC, they're not interested in investigating the story and catching the bad guys. They're interested that you found out about it and got outside the company to tell the SEC. From there, it's really career suicide, because they let you think that there are these protections in place for whistleblowers, but when you get out there, in fact, these protections are used against the people blowing the whistle in many cases.
So why did you agree to this interview?
Nothing's more deadly to a creature of illusion and obscurity than light and clarity. And so the idea was to, within our own means, share this information, share some of the documentation, so that the average person out there who's being taken advantage of through this corporatized version of media suppression and censorship, letting you find your own way through the dark, can have an easier time, because we can make things a little less obscure by shedding a little light into these shadows where the media doesn't want you to explore.
How does Ayn Rand's philosophy contribute to the current economic downturn?
Nothing's more deadly to a creature of illusion and obscurity than light and clarity comes from Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, which is the blueprint, basically, or the operating system of the elite people who work to create these frauds and perpetrate them against the unwitting masses. I guess it's kind of because Atlas Shrugged was used as an inspiration by these elite executives to commit these acts of accounting fraud and control fraud. And the fact that we can take this information and use it for our benefit to expose these accounting frauds and these control frauds allows us to add to a dynamic that they're not planning. I'm going to go to the next slide.
What reference could you recommend to simplify and explain the types of accounting and control fraud that was ongoing?
The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One by Professor William Black. And it's regarding all of this Sarbanes-Oxley and this control fraud, so I just thought for a second I'd share. This is page 247. It's important to understand fraud mechanisms. Control frauds were consistently able to fool top economists because they did not understand how CEOs turn accountants and accounting principles from a restraint into a weapon of fraud and a shield against the regulators. Economists receive no training about fraud risk, incidents, or mechanisms. Lawyers receive no fraud training, right? And this is kind of what led up to the Enron scandal. The lawyers and the accountants aren't familiar with what fraud looks like. They're not being trained to recognize it. The average accountant receives no meaningful training about fraud and no training at all about control fraud. Control fraud is not random.
How did you earn your first $1 million before you were 30?
How did I earn my first million before I was 30? Through the effective use of rhetoric and persuasive speech, otherwise known as corporate sales.
Are you willing to share what you've learned through your experience in executive sales and consequent whistleblowing with the audience?
Well, I've mentioned that I don't know of any university that gives a degree in sales, and we can also get into that later, why they don't give out that information to just anybody. But if I shared in detail, if I shared in deep detail everything that I've learned, then you'd be left to believe me. And that's not what I'm looking for. What I'm looking for is to teach you how to learn by presenting you with some of these different components, because it doesn't do me any good for you to believe me. What would do me a lot of good is for other people on the other side of the screen to start to understand these control mechanisms, these fraud mechanisms, how to realize it, to recognize that the media that you're paying for is, you're paying for lies. You're not getting the truth you need to make informed decisions. And so rather than me sharing and you just listening and believing, I would like you to actively participate, give some thought to what I'm saying, maybe take some notes, do some research, and maybe even email and follow up afterwards, because I'm interested to find out, you know, there are millions of people who have been ripped off by these frauds, and there are trillions of dollars that have been stolen from the American people. So I know that there are people out there with resources that can take the information that we're trying to put out and give us the extra boost to be able to get it in front of people. But the first thing you need to understand is the frauds as I've experienced them, and what I've experienced through trying to go to Frontline and these other media outlets that call themselves investigative journalists, when really they're just looking to present you with a story that lets you think that something's being taken care of. They'll show you one whistleblower. Oh, here's the woman from Halliburton, and isn't her story great? But they won't show you the 500 other whistleblowers that allow you to see these frauds from a comprehensive 360-degree Google Earth type of perspective where you could do something about it and effectively pass on what you've learned, which is what we're trying to do here.
Who specifically did you approach at PBS Frontline to investigate your claims and publish your evidence?
The reporter we went to at Frontline was named Lowell Bergman.
What made you trust in Frontline, and specifically in Lowell Bergman?
A couple weeks before I contacted Lowell Bergman, I had screened a film with Russell Crowe, and Lowell Bergman was portrayed in the film by Al Pacino. It was called The Insider, and it's about this whistleblower named John Wiegand, and he worked for a cigarette company named Brown & Williamson. He was in a similar situation to what I found myself in. He faxed Lowell Bergman in the movie, so I thought, why not look up, you know, this guy's fax number, send him a fax. We corresponded with Bergman. He said, yes, send me all of your evidence. Send a big box of evidence out there with voice recordings and legal documents and all this evidence that I'd collected through what I'd been through that far in my court case. And he had two people working on the investigation of checking out these documents and checking out my claims, and more importantly, the connections that my claims were pointing to between the White House and the founder of the company that I was working at, and the Sarbanes-Oxley regulations and the SEC's role in these events. And after a year and a half, I was told that he couldn't do anything for me, that one of the editors had been fired, that the other editor's job at the San Francisco Chronicle had his career threatened and decided he wanted to keep his career. And so after a year and a half of believing that this information was going to make it to the American people vis-a-vis Frontline, I had to come to the realization that there are some entities out there, in fact, many entities, that benefit specifically from you not getting this information.
What was the gist of what you sought Bergman to investigate?
I wasn't so much interested in Frontline doing a story on me. What I found to be interesting was after I had identified that there was a backdoor in the product that I was selling. And the product I was selling was Sarbanes-Oxley regulation software that was being used by financial services company across all over the world, but specifically across America. And once I understood that the purpose of Sarbanes-Oxley regulations was to keep these companies from deleting files, and that the backdoor in the software allowed these companies to delete files, and more importantly, the fact that someone outside of the company that's not even associated with the company but has access to that software could launder money or steal money or just delete money from corporations and switch financial records all around without anyone, any investigator, any auditor being able to audit that. Those things I thought were interesting, but when the SEC, after I told them, bought the software with the back door in it and was started to use it for itself, then I knew that the SEC was not there to regulate like I thought it was. They were also, hey, we can find a benefit from this back door in the software. We can delete files now. Now we're above the law. And so essentially the people who were perpetrating the scam also had control, or at least controlling influence, over the supposed investigatory organizations and agencies. And that's what I thought the American people needed to find out through Lowell Bergman, because the traditional press, the newspapers we went to, wanted nothing to do with this because it conflicted with their advertisers. So I was hoping that since Bergman did such a good job and was featured in this Hollywood film and had helped this other whistleblower, that, you know, it would be appropriate for him to at least investigate the story and if there was something to it. But he didn't come back and say there's nothing to your story. He said there's so much to your story that we can't publish it.
Regarding what you witnessed and what you realized, what specifically posed a threat to the integrity of the U.S. economy?
The fact that that backdoor is in the software allows any number of companies across America, which, you know, there were tens of thousands of companies that were mandated to have this type of software. Now that they have this regulatory software where if you don't have it, you'll be audited, you know, and you'll get slapped on the wrist or worse. And if you do have the software, now you're exposed to this gigantic fraud, which the operators of a company may or may not be participating or aware in. And so there's the potential for setting up patsy companies, for controlling your competition, for all sorts of diabolical financial malfeasance, essentially. And it gave them like a curtain, and even the auditors and the accountants can't see behind this curtain because of this new software, which further obscures the fraud from any investigator's ability to see into it because they're not familiar enough with the software.
When did these events take place, and what was your experience which led you to believe that there was a clear and present danger to the economy?
This happened in the summer of 2003 and extended till January of 2004 when I was terminated, but I first became aware in July of 2003. I was in a meeting with one of my clients, which was Tyco International, which was one of these companies that was exposed in this accounting fraud. And at the time that I was at my client at Tyco, they were under investigation and under mandate by the FBI and the SEC not to delete any data. And their problem was data was building up all over the place, especially in their email. So I went in there with this Sarbanes-Oxley product to say, what happened because you didn't have our product. And now that you're under these mandates, these are good. We can help you clean this all up. In fact, our product can help you save disk space. And it was at that point that the person with whom we were meeting, Valley Baldassano, who is the chief general counsel of Tyco International and her team, Valley says to myself and my technical team that she's not interested in keeping this data. She wants to know how to delete this data, and she wants to know how to delete this data beyond the scrutiny of FBI and SEC. I know nothing about this, so I'm thinking this is really out of context, to which point one of the technical guys on my team says, hey, I know what you're talking about that, and we can talk about that offline or whatever. And they let me finish my presentation because I'd only worked there a couple weeks, but that stuck in my head. So a few weeks later, in August of 2003, I was at a client called the NASD, which has later changed its name, so it's now called the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. And the NASD was looking at our product, and they wanted to use it internally. And one of the guys across the table says to me, hey, wait a minute. This product has a back door, because right here where you're supposed to take this information and put it on the write once, read many storage, which is a type of permanent storage, he said, there's this jar file, and you can delete the jar file, and then there's no evidence of that transaction whatsoever. So he was showing me across the table that there's a loophole, there's a back door in the software that allows nefarious transactions to go on. And subsequently they didn't buy the software. They're like, this is bullshit. This isn't worth the money. This is not what it's supposed to be. And you should do something about that. Now I had management from my side in the meeting. And so I went to my managers afterwards and I'm like, what's this all about? And what's going on with this? And I was told not to talk about it.
Can you tell me what type of evidence you had and what you actually provided to Lowell Bergman?
What I sent to Bergman were emails, voice recordings of executives admitting and asking me to violate various rules, regulations, laws, what have you, asking me to falsify financial statements that were later used in July of 2003's acquisition of Legato, which is the company I worked for, by EMC Corporation, which is the company I ended up working for after the merger.
How did your software relate to the Sarbanes-Oxley regulations implemented in 2002 to prevent companies like Tyco and Enron from manipulating their records and violating the public trust?
All right, so people are understanding that there are companies like WorldCom and Tyco and Enron that were betraying the public trust. They were doing accounting fraud, and basically they were taking debts from their companies and then creating shell companies and giving the debt over here. So on the Tyco books or on the Enron books, it looked like they had all this money and all this profit, and they were hiding their losses in a separate entity. Sarbanes-Oxley came in and said the software that has to be used by the parent corporation, let's say Tyco International, now has to be such that you cannot delete email messages for a certain amount of time. So certain types of documents now have what's called a life cycle, and there came all these pieces of software to handle data life cycle management. How long do corporations need to keep different pieces of data? And Sarbanes-Oxley said, well, regarding financial transactions, here's how you have to keep data, here's how you have to preserve email, and you have to preserve the data in a specific way. You would take the data and transfer it to what's called a write once, read many type of storage, which is a permanent type of drive storage that once you put data on there, you can read it, but you can't delete it. And if you delete it, there's all these serial numbers and you can tell that someone deleted it. So it prevents them from going around and shredding proverbial documents in the electronic world and allows oversight to take place by investigative authorities or auditing committees.
So let me get this clear. You discovered that the software you were selling to financial services companies in New York City, which was required by Sarbanes-Oxley, a law designed to prevent fraud, in reality being used to perpetuate an even deeper fraud, and that the software was used to further obscure the fraud from the public view?
Well, exactly, and it's like a protection racket. So financial services companies, after 2002, because of Sarbanes-Oxley, now had to buy a certain type of software that did certain things to preserve data. And that was part of the law. So they're by law required to get this software. And if you don't get it, the FBI and the SEC will come in and audit you, and you'll get all these penalties and fines, and your stock will go down. So it's like a big scare tactic. So companies are, they use fear to get companies to buy into this. But then once the companies actually buy that regulatory Sarbanes-Oxley software that we're selling, they're exposed by way of a back door where anybody who understands the software can come in and loot their company, and the investors, the operators, the everyone who's involved with it may or may not be privy to that. And so it gets into this whole, not even a gray area, it gets into this whole shadow world where actions can be taken, but there's no way to hold people accountable or to raise levels of accountability and awareness and see what went on. It simply goes into this proverbial black hole. So that's the danger.
What specifically is the vulnerability in the Sarbanes-Oxley regulatory compliance software that you were tasked to sell, and how does it work technically?
All right, so the vulnerability is during the transit of data to the write once, read many file, that there's a staging area for the data where it's collected in what's called a jar file. And somebody can go in and delete that jar file, making it look like the data never got to the storage, and so it's not checked in with the serial number, and it's gone from here, and so it creates this black hole or a back door, or it's a point of vulnerability that's specifically located such that it can be exploited to the nth degree before anyone figures out where's the money going and where's the leak. The boat will have already sank.
I read in your court transcripts that both the SEC and FBI had arrested a Northrop Grumman executive and an executive from your company, Legato, for something called side contracts. Could you explain how that ties into another one of your clients, DynCorp, as well?
September of 2003, I read an SEC press release, if you will, that cited one of my clients from Logicon, which is a subsidiary of Northrop Grumman, which is a client, and DynCorp, and being indicted and people being arrested. Now, my misunderstanding at the time was that the SEC arrested people, and I found out in my court case that it's actually the FBI who arrest people for the SEC. So I had misunderstood it to that extent, who was the arresting agency, but the point from my concern was I'm working with knowingly fraudulent software. I'm reporting it up through my management in a company. It seems like everyone's okay with this. And at the same time, clients of mine are being hit for, you know, and arrested for these side contracts. And at that time, I'd become aware that through this press release that my clients, both sides, DynCorp and Northrop Grumman, were engaging in what they call these side agreements, these side deals, which on paper for accounting standards, they make it look one way, but then they cut this other set of deals. And this is really how the deal works. And it's off the radar and it's not auditable.
Now, wasn't DynCorp involved with both sex trafficking and money missing from the Pentagon?
DynCorp was providing the anthrax and other vaccines to our soldiers. They were doing accounting for the Pentagon and responsible for oversight on $2.3 trillion that went missing on the day before 9/11. On 9/10/01, this money, $2.3 trillion, is announced by the Pentagon that it's missing. And the next day on 9/11/01, the accounting department of the Pentagon with the accountants overseeing this money that's missing blows up.
I thank the gentlelady from Georgia, Ms. McKinney.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Secretary, I watched President Bush deliver a moving speech at the United Nations in September 2003, in which he mentioned the crisis of the sex trade. The president called for the punishment of those involved in this horrible business. But at the very moment of that speech, DynCorp was exposed for having been involved in the buying and selling of young women and children. While all of this was going on, DynCorp kept the Pentagon contract to administer the smallpox and anthrax vaccines and is now working on a plague vaccine through the Joint Vaccine Acquisition Program. Mr. Secretary, is it policy of the U.S. government to reward companies that traffic in women and little girls? That's my first question. My second question, Mr. Secretary, according to the Comptroller General of the United States, there are serious financial management problems at the Pentagon, to which Mr. Cooper alluded. Fiscal year 1999, $2.3 trillion missing. Fiscal year 2000, $1.1 trillion missing. And DOD is the number one reason why the government can't balance its checkbook. The Pentagon has claimed year after year that the reason it can't account for the money is because its computers don't communicate with each other. My second question, Mr. Secretary, is who has the contracts today to make those systems communicate with each other? How long have they had those contracts? And how much have the taxpayers paid for them? Finally, Mr. Secretary, after the last hearing, I thought that my office was promised a written response to my question regarding the four war games on September 11th. I have not yet received that response, but would like for you to respond to the questions that I've put to you today, and then I do expect the written response to my previous question, hopefully by the end of the week.
Thank you, Representative. First, the answer to your first question is no, absolutely not. The policy of the United States government is clear, unambiguous, and opposed to the activities that you described. The second question.
Well, how do you explain the fact that DynCorp and its successor companies have received and continue to receive government contracts?
I would have to go and find the facts, but there are laws and rules and regulations with respect to government contracts. And there are times that corporations do things they should not do, in which case they tend to be suspended for some period. There are times then that the under the laws and the rules and regulations for the that passed by the Congress and implemented by the executive branch, that corporations can get off of out of the penalty box, if you will, and be permitted to engage in contracts with the government. They're not generally not barred in perpetuity.
This company was never in the penalty box. If you could proceed to my second question, please.
The second question. I've forgotten what the second question was.
Now, from reading your court transcripts, it was evident that not only did you do your due diligence, but that you escalated your concerns to the executives at Legato and EMC, as well as alerting the SEC. Could you elaborate?
I had asked my management and hadn't gotten direct answers. I raised and escalated my level of concern through management in my company. And at that time, the EMC-Legato merger had finished, so EMC was now the corporation in charge. And they weren't interested, so I went to the SEC. I called the attorney who was involved with the SEC's investigation of Northrop Grumman, and I said, look, I see the situation that you guys are investigating and arresting these people on. It seems similar to a situation that I have going on here. These are my clients. There are side letters with other clients that are going on that existed before I even got here. I haven't worked here long. I'm trying to understand the lay of the land. He indicated to me that if I shared any further information with the SEC, that I could be held liable and I could be sued and possibly worse. And it was not a warm and welcoming, hey, you're a whistleblower, come share this information with us. He was more telling me, if you proceed with this, we're going to make it hard on you because we don't want this information out there. Again, they just like they don't teach the accountants and the lawyers about fraud, they didn't teach me, getting my business degree, about how to recognize fraud in these companies and what to do and what your rights are and what protections there are and what resources there are. And they certainly don't tell you that if you raise this question, you're going to give up a multi-million dollar career because you asked this question and persisted in finding out the answer. And the protections you think you'll use to get that answer are actually, you know, just there to get you to give that information so they could knit it up and tie up all the loose ends. The very person that I provided the information to in the form of blowing the whistle and requesting this specific protections engaged and provided by Sarbanes-Oxley was the general counsel of a multi-billion dollar corporation that had just bought my company. And he showed vehemently that he was not interested in receiving this information because he ordered my termination instead of protecting me as the law mandates.
And when did you make this call to the SEC?
I made the call to the SEC on October 24th, 2003, which was my 30th birthday.
My impression from reading the court transcripts was that you didn't get what you expected from the SEC. What were your thoughts at the time?
Well, I was surprised because I went to them expecting to take this evidence and at least have them look at it and say, there's something here or there's nothing here. But when they said, you know, you could get in trouble for sharing this with us, we don't really want to know about this. If it's going on and people are at risk, then, you know, kind of so be it. And provably afterwards, soon thereafterwards, the SEC released a press release announcing that they were using Legato's email extender product to guarantee the integrity of their financial transactions and their records and all the auditing and all the audit trails that need to be there to work as in a transparent manner as they're supposed to do.
So how did the Sarbanes-Oxley regulations affect the pricing structure of the pre-existing email compliance software?
They sold the product in Europe, but they sold the product at a much lower price, and the product was, let's say, $18 per user here in America. So for a corporation that has thousands of people, they would have thousands of these licenses. And once the Sarbanes-Oxley regulations were passed, the company that I worked for, Legato, then raised their prices from $18 to $40 without adding any additional functionality. And in fact, that product had a backdoor that opens up all these other nefarious areas and areas of risk. So it was doing opposite of the job that people were buying it for. So all in all, there's thousands of companies that bought that product and that were potentially exposed without being able to have the benefit of being warned.
If I'm understanding this correctly, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002 mandates that so-called compliance software must be purchased and used across all financial services companies and beyond. So the question is, what new risks and or blind spots were created and have yet to be identified as a result of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act?
The corporations not only had to buy the software, but they had a personal reason why they wanted to have the software, to preserve the integrity of their financial records, to guarantee that if they were audited, they would have the records to show any investigating agency, here, we're operating above board, here's all of our records, we're not running shell companies, we're not laundering money, here it all is. When you have a company that's investing so much money, hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars in this software, to prevent, you know, their organization from being called on its integrity or impugning its integrity, thus having the stock go down in the news, they have this as a safeguard. So they invest all this money in a safeguard, and the safeguard actually is putting them more at risk. And as recent as last week, the Supreme Court indicated that Sarbanes-Oxley is fine as it is, and that there's no need to change it because it works perfectly for the purposes for which they put it there.
So what about money laundering?
Well, this entirely opens up hundreds of thousands of areas within these thousands of companies where money laundering can take place, because there's a variety of places you can store these files and a variety of ways that people have provably gone through and used in methodologies of hiding transactions from people who are posing scrutiny or auditing such transactions, right? So what it does is it allows any publicly traded company that was regulated through Sarbanes-Oxley to buy a product, and at least we know from the one from Legato was equipped with a backdoor. I would assume it's competition from IBM and other companies who are doing similar things, because you really haven't heard a lot about accounting fraud and all these companies that got busted. You haven't heard that trend. What you've heard is that these companies need to be bailed out. We pay them off. We give them all this money, and we have no idea where the money went, and they're not producing the records. I mean, this is the whole problem. They have gotten rid of these records. Even if you go and investigate, it's like the White House had lost 4 million emails during the Bush administration. And when his good buddy that he appointed ambassador to Ireland, Richard Egan, is the chairman and founder of EMC Corporation that is providing this email documentation and storage ability so you can permanently keep all this stuff, and you're supposed to be doing this, right? When Bush has access, he's buddies with this guy. Egan was one of Bush's biggest fundraisers. So don't tell me that the White House doesn't have access to the software that could prevent the deletion of those emails. Rather, they sought to obscure and censor and suppress that information that they had, make it look like it never existed, and all of a sudden 4 million messages are gone. And as far as I was under the understanding, government is something about our consent. Those people were there working, getting paid with our tax dollars. They need to be accountable. And when the president can just lose 4 million emails and we can't see if he met with Enron people before the energy meetings and all this other stuff, like how the policies got formed, all that stuff secret, those emails are missing, that's BS, because Sarbanes-Oxley specifically was there to understand that these frauds had taken place because these procedures weren't in place, so it's supposed to put these procedures there so that these companies get caught. But really, it just gave an early warning system so that people could, these corporations and the executives could understand when employees were onto them, and they were getting tipped off, and they're getting fed information. And at the end of the day, the legal process doesn't work. The Fourth Estate, i.e. the media industrial complex, is not doing its job for the public. They've sold out their audiences for sake of making more advertising dollars and keeping a copacetic relationship with these other corporations. As these frauds progress, they give it the soft sell, the underhand pitch, and there's never any critical thinking or hard questions asked to any of these executives.
So it's a type of protection racket.
It's absolutely a protection racket, because if you don't buy the product, you're going to get audited by the SEC and possibly investigated by the FBI. If you do buy the product, you're spending $100,000 or $1 million to protect your company, when really that exposes your company to more risk than if you didn't have this software in the first place.
So when you see today's economic calamity in progress, what do you see?
Well, what I see is something that A, could have been prevented, B, should have been prevented, and C, if the media had done its job, would have been prevented, because I understand that if you give this information to people, they would take action to protect their interests. And that's all I wanted to do at the end of the day, was to get this information out there so that they could protect their interests before they lost their money and their life savings and eventually their country, because the frauds add up to a big change that Americans don't yet recognize what this all means. But there's definitely a trend going on. There's actions being taken that all add up to a bigger picture. And without this connection between ourselves and the public, if we rely on media to do this communicating for us, it'll never get done. So we have to break down these walls and present this information in ways such that people can comprehend it, and then give them the access to go look for themselves. I mean, if you look at the revolving doors and look in 1998 when they repealed Glass-Steagall, and then the same people who did that then went to these other corporations and took advantage of it, and then they got in government again and they're getting the bailouts, and you know, Robert Rubin stole hundreds of billions of dollars with his cohorts. That makes what Madoff did look like kindergarten, and yet the media is all showing people it's only Madoff. No, it's a much broader proliferation of organized fraud that was ongoing and could have been, should have been prevented had the SEC and supposedly investigative journalistic outlets like Frontline done their job and reported on the story and actually had some investigative journalism and some muckraking and doing something to provide their audience with the information that could have been provided to them on a timely basis. But now it's 5 years later.
So we're left to...
So instead, we're left to evolve, adapt, and overcome through the situation, realize that the media is not going to do it for us, that these regulatory and protection agencies aren't going to do it for us. So we have to recognize as Americans and start running the economy of America within ourselves, because the people we've tasked with it, the people we've trusted with it, have broken trust. They have. And J.P. Morgan has a famous quote on how all money and financial transactions, and that's the first thing that goes when you're lending money, is trust. If there's no trust, there's no business. And what I'm saying is that the major businesses that are running this country and controlling our economy have broken trust with everybody in this country, that whether they're aware of it or whether they're an investor or whether they're just a person on the street who has to deal with the increasing cost of everything, right? The businessmen that have been running America for the past, you know, 30, 40 years have created an obsolescent America. It's meant to go defunct. It's the market's meant to crash. They've inflated it to the point where it's so far from reality that it has to return to reality. And it's gotten this far away from reality because the journalism that needed to take place to keep the illusion down here at a manageable level did not take place. And it's in this space right here that the crash has been taking place, and it's going to get worse if people do not recognize that the people that we've been trusting to do these things have not been living up to their jobs, and that we need to do some replacements. We need to fire some people and hire some new people. There needs to be vetting. There needs to be people getting the job who are qualified for the job and understanding and experienced in the job. And it doesn't necessarily need to be a buddy of the president's and whatnot. Because right now the SEC reports to the president. So at the end of the day, when the SEC was telling me they're not interested, they're telling me they're not interested because I'm tying the Bush administration in with billionaire Richard Egan and his company that's helping these companies do this. It's like, they, of course they don't want to sponsor that getting out to the public. It just took me a long time to figure out those dynamics and to understand and to learn by trial and error and fall down many times with going to John Stossel before we went to Lowell Bergman and all these other people that you would think, oh, call so-and-so, they'll publish the story. Let me tell you, we contacted them. They don't want anything to do with telling you what's really going on because it does not profit them. And this doesn't profit me either, but I feel a lot better just being able to express. And so people who have lost their life savings have an understanding why and can start to go figure out and get their own answers. But know that you've been lied to by the people who do your nightly news and print your daily paper. They could have, would have, should have told you this stuff had they not been so addicted to the profiteering that goes on in today's media markets.
So what were the results of working with Bergman, if you don't mind me asking?
So after I sent Bergman and his team this big legal box full of documents, voice recordings, everything that I had comprehensively laid out so that you could go step by step and understand what's going on. Here's the documentation. Here's the evidence. Here's the audio evidence. It links out. So comprehensive, provide this to them. They're going through it for a year and a half. They're progressing through. They're verifying. They're asking questions. One of the editors that Bergman has working on it loses his job. The other gentleman who worked at the San Francisco Chronicle said, I was told if I continue with this story that I'll lose my job, at which point Bergman says, there's nothing I can do. I can't help you. I can't publish this story. There's too much resistance. So he wasn't saying your facts don't check out. He wasn't saying there's nothing to, you know, nothing going on, that the SEC had a very logical explanation or any of this stuff. He's saying, I cannot publish this story and keep my job. And that's what it's all about for them. It's about money. So if you can't make money by telling my story, nobody wants to tell it. So, you know, there you have it. That's how they keep whistleblowers suppressed. It doesn't have to all be about secrecy. It has purely to do with economics, people's personal interests, people's personal ties, conflict of interest on the other side of, you know, where people are supposed to be providing information to the public, and people who are betraying the public trust, seeking to keep that kind of away from the public view, so they can continue their fraud.
So then, going back to your court case, what law firm represented EMC in this matter?
So I take the case to court, and EMC is being represented by this law firm called Skadden, Arps, Marr, and Flom. And at the time, I didn't have any context. I wasn't a specialist in law firms or know what law firms did what. So I'm left to, you know, just kind of go at it. It's some law firm I've never heard of. I go into court, and there's these huge attorneys that were like 6'6 and 6'9, and very intimidating and imposing figures. As I came to find out after the fact, Skadden, Arps was involved in defending characters from the BCCI money laundering and drug importation scandal. They were involved in defending people from Iran-Contra, and most recently they were defending the airlines from the 9/11 victims' families, ensuring that the people who had questions and were going about lawsuits had a much, much harder time and a much more of an uphill battle, because they were going up against the largest law firm in America and one of the largest law firms in the world, who was specifically empowered by J.P. Morgan and company in the 40s and 50s when they wanted to, when J.P. Morgan wanted to do hostile takeovers, and Davis, Polk, and Wardell, which was J.P. Morgan's traditional law firm, said that's too dirty for us. So they found this other law firm called Skadden Arps, and Skadden Arps was happy to do continuous business. So when I read that in this House of Morgan book, I was almost to the end of my trial, and I was in the part where I was writing the final brief for my court case. So on page 599 of the House of Morgan, at this juncture, Morgan Stanley made another unorthodox decision. Like Morgan Guaranty, the firm had long relied on a WASP white glove law firm of Davis, Polk, and Wardell, which had looked upon takeover work as vulgar and avoided it. And then it says that this guy Greenhill insisted upon hiring the experienced Joe Flom of Skadden, Arps, Slate, Marr, and Flom, which is interesting because they would be chosen, you know, by their applicability to the situation, because EMC has numerous attorneys it works with all over the world. It's a global company, so they had to choose one. It's like choosing an instrument or a tool for a task. So when you look at what Skadden Arps is notorious for and what their specialty is, doing the work that other law firms don't feel comfortable with, then their proximity to this situation and it involving accusals of money laundering and backdoors and software and all the other things that were involved, including the systematic violation of whistleblower protections and defending that in court and thinking that was a good idea. I mean, it was a learning experience. It was a growth experience. I mean, it was a maturing experience. I spent my 33rd birthday in court. That was my first day of giving testimony. So I gave 8 or 9 hours of testimony the first day. It was a 3-day trial. And the second day, I called EMC's witnesses as my own witnesses. I gave them the line of questioning. They put their statements on the record, and then they weren't able to be used by EMC against me because they had already told the truth in court because I asked them the right questions, and the one I had to impeach using an audio tape. But the point was, they were kind of left toothless because of this move that I did where I called their witnesses as my own.
And what law firm represented you in this matter?
I ended up representing myself. Much to my dismay, after taking the case and the evidence, and including the audio evidence, to numerous attorneys, including all the attorneys you hear about on TV that you might think, hey, they're someone who sticks up for the little guy, or they're always representing someone who, you know, in these important cases, they wanted nothing to do with it, and they were point blank saying it would cross lines. It would be a conflict of interest for them to release this information, at which point I was left to do nothing other than act as a pro se litigant to learn the legal system and to learn the rules of civil procedure and whatnot, how to present a case in court. And I'd say the weakest point was it's hard to, when you're on the witness stand, to object because you're thinking about answering the question, and so you answer questions instead of objecting and saying, I shouldn't answer that question or whatever. So they end up trying to get you in a line of testimony and then use it back on you, and luckily I was able to defend myself with the evidence to an adequate degree to the point where they could not prove any of their points, and they ended up bringing these witnesses in that I used to prove my case.
What was the result of your court case?
Well, the result of the court case was, after taking, you know, this is just, you know, one book of the exhibits, you know, here's another book of exhibits, there's plenty. But after presenting these exhibits, getting them on the record, and having them stand up as the evidence of the day, meaning that the other side couldn't disprove the points I was making, I felt very confident that I had won my case because I had won in court by presenting the evidence and getting my story told without them impeaching me, without them saying that, I'm lying or making any of this up. I was able to convince the judge, and the judge is like, okay, there were times I wanted to present more evidence, and the judge says, since they can't contest it, it stands as the evidence of the day, and you don't need to present anymore. So when you're being told things like this, where you've already laid it all out comprehensively, I was very confident and thought, well, I did my job. At the end of the day, when the judge finally made a decision, it was about 6 months after the trial ended, and you have to do a final brief, which for me was like 300 pages. At the end of the day, the judge says in the document that they find in favor of the corporation because the events that I claimed did in fact take place. Everything that I said in court and proved in court and put in court, including Respondent Exhibit 7, which is Project Constellation, which deals with all these experiences and lays out how it ties into a larger fraud, so that they tried to use that against me. So after presenting all this and having it there and it's on the record, they were left to do nothing except say, what you said is true, but it happened slightly outside of the statute of limitations, and therefore I have no power as the judge to do anything to this corporation. Now, in fact, I filed well within the statute of limitations. The actions were within the statute of limitations, and the case had been ongoing for almost 4 years at that point through multiple agencies, including the United States Department of Labor under OSHA for the Sarbanes-Oxley regulation. That's where it has to start, and then you can progress it into court, which is what I did. And after all of that, they're left with no other option but to say, these events happen, they are true, they are factual, here's what happened, but they're outside of statute of limitations, and so there is no remedy. And so I was left with nothing.
So there's no appeals process?
Well, I could continue appealing, but after you've already seen what happened, you go in and put it all on the record, and it's all right there. They just do not want to – they're not going to decide against a multi-billion-dollar corporation whose founder is the ambassador to Ireland for President Bush at that time, right? Or I believe he might have stepped down as an ambassador at that point, but he was still Bush buddies, and Bush was still in office, so –
So you proved in court that the general counsel of EMC, Paul Dacier, to whom you blew the whistle, is the same person who ordered that you be immediately terminated for doing so? Isn't that against the law?
Not only is it against the law, but Paul Dacier, who's the general counsel for EMC Corporation, gets a salary of maybe $1.6 million a year. So his job, in addition to overseeing EMC's aviation and real estate interests, are to deal with claims such as mine. He's on the supposed audit committee of the corporation, which is mandated by Sarbanes-Oxley, which I found out does not exist. Right. And that the phone number you call is a hoax phone number and all this stuff. So Paul Dacier, when I told him that I'm blowing the whistle, I'm claiming these protections, etc., his first move was to figure out how to terminate me for cause, for what they called cause. And when I questioned them about what is cause, they said for reasons. Okay? And it came out in court through their witnesses, through people who still worked at the company, that Paul Dacier is the one who ordered them to terminate me. So, direct violation of numerous whistleblower protection laws, and other whistleblowers should know before they lose their career and their livelihood and their financial future.
So would you say then that the protection is just theater?
That protection is absolutely only theater. It's an illusion to let you think that you have some... I'm sure in some cases it is enforced, but let it be known that if you're onto something real and you have real evidence, that they are going to move heaven and earth to try to keep those things from getting out to the public. And the things that are in paper, whether it's been from the KeyTAM Act, where your corporation or your employer is ripping off the government, which is 1865 put into place by Abraham Lincoln, or it's the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002 and you're selling the software to these companies and telling them they need it, and then you find out that you have to blow the whistle under that act, under those protections, and that those protections that you've been educating your clients on do not exist.
So, is Sarbanes-Oxley a thing of the past, something which caused the ongoing financial depression, or is its effect still in progress?
The Sarbanes-Oxley regulations that have been in place since 2002 are not only still in effect, but recently, December 8th, 2009, the United States Supreme Court appeared inclined to leave well enough alone Monday and not tinker with the structure of an accounting oversight board created by the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002. Congress created the board in the aftermath of the Enron and WorldCom accounting scandals, giving the board broad and independent power to regulate accounting firms which had been self-regulated before. Its five members are appointed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, not the president, and the board's members, like those of the commission, can only be fired for cause and not for policy disagreements, right? And so what they're showing you is that they've created this oversight board that's supposed to make sure Sarbanes-Oxley is working well, and the Supreme Court thinks it's working so well that they just want to keep it going and that there's nothing to fix. Now, I'm not part of some plan to try to regulate or like renovate or, you know, readjust Sarbanes-Oxley. I'm just saying the way it's being used right now, it's being used as a weapon and not as a safety mechanism. And I think that's important for people, including investors and people who are being taken advantage of, to know sooner than later. I think that just makes logical sense.
So it looks to me like the problems you identified were actually very profitable revenue streams, and that the SEC is really there to potentially protect the frauds instead of protecting the public interest?
from the consumer side, these frauds are very confusing and they don't seem to make a lot of sense. But from the corporate side and from the regulation side, the people are making profits, so they make a lot of sense. C-E-N-T-S. They're making a lot of money from this. And that's why they don't want people to know, so because they'd have to stop it. They'd have to adapt, evolve, and overcome just like we do every day to get through. So the idea that you could have these mechanisms in place, you could have an agency like the SEC giving these companies a warning, hey, you had an employee call here today and try to give us information, you better run a tighter ship. Or the Sarbanes-Oxley Oversight Board, which when a whistleblower goes to any sort of accounting oversight board involved with the corporation, that is being directly turned over to say the corporation says, hey, self-preservation first. If we can break the law and get away with it, isn't that just a way of making more money and that lives up to the corporate mandate? They're there to survive at first cost. And that's what the VP of Human Resources and the General Counsel of EMC did. They thought about their job and their multi-million dollar salary before they thought of, hey, is this kid onto something? Could it actually be a danger to the company? Are we endangering our clients? Are we endangering the economy as a whole? They didn't seem to be really caring about that.
What's the root cause or primary motivation of these actions taken by regulatory and corporate decision makers? And how would you summarize that for the audience in simplest terms?
That was my concern. I thought I was getting into that company to sell this software to help bring, you know, all this nefarious fiscal activity going on in our economy under control. By putting this software in there, I thought I was making, you know, these clients safer. And I thought I was using my time wisely, and it was helping to defend our economy, which kind of seemed to be in trouble after 9/11, right? Only to find that this software is intentionally created to give the illusion of protection while really making everyone at a higher risk. It allowed the people who were perpetrating the crimes to do it at a lower risk, but it was raising the risk of the corporation who was trying to mitigate its risks, right? So it made it easier for the people who were stealing money. It made it harder for investigators to catch them. It made it almost impossible for corporations to even know if they were a victim. And the American people never had a chance because our media outlets that you know, I would say between 30 and 40 different media outlets we tried that, you know, we were just either not responded to, or they said it doesn't pertain to their readers, or that they would like to carry it, but their advertisers would disagree. So, yeah, or it's too big. It's appropriate and it's pertinent to too many people that they don't know how to handle it because they're just a small newspaper here in Connecticut, the Hartford Courant or something like that. This story is too big. And they tell you, hey, why don't you go to the Wall Street Journal? Well, because a lot of those companies in the Wall Street Journal are only making a lot of money because of this thing that I'm trying to tell you that is endangering all of our economy, because the international companies that are doing this to us, they don't necessarily even have a lot of jobs in America, some of these international banks that are running this and using this software to prey on other groups of banks that are unwitting to this sort of thing. So it was really an eye-opening and a growing experience. And yeah, I was a little bit bitter when I had my hefty paycheck and my comfortable lifestyle and all the amenities and accoutrements of that lifestyle taken away from me. But at the end of the day, I just realized that it happened to me because I didn't know enough about the game. I trusted what I had been told. I trusted what I believed. I trusted that these checks and balances that I was educated to understand were there. I trusted that those safety nets were really there, these protections. If I actually thought that by sending an email or making a call or doing any of the things that I did to end up in that situation would have led to you're going to kill your career, you're not going to be able to buy a house and have kids and do all this stuff for several years afterwards, well, then I might have, you know, thought differently about it. But luckily at the time I was naive enough to, you know, just do what I did.
Does the ongoing hype regarding the global economic depression scare you?
Well, no, because I know, A, all this hype is contrived. It's there to use fear to sell things, right? I know that any calamity that's going on right now can be prevented if we restore the mechanisms that allowed it to become broken in the first place. And that starts with communicating these things and getting them out to people who might be able to better fund independent media outlets and get this information to the people, since the traditional Fourth Estate's no longer doing its job.
What do you know that others who fear our economic future do not realize?
Well, I know that it's a game being played out there. I know that some of the people in the game, their job is to act like they're there to protect the market and all this other stuff. And when you understand that those people have different agendas and that they're playing with other people's emotions and playing with people's lives and their retirements and their futures or their families and things like this, that you have to step back at it and almost look at it as a game too. And the problem is not enough people have been looking at this illusion and saying, all right, let's figure out how to dissolve and dissemble this illusion. Let's show how, you know, these things that have been going on are are visible from these angles and help people see these things. Whereas, you know, to do something less than that would be to engage in propagating those illusions. It'd be to, you know, cheer on Jim Cramer as he leads more investors off the cliff.
What role does fear play in consumerism and market dynamics?
Well, what I understand is that fear is a mechanism that it was traditionally used for survival, and that people at a certain point came to understand that we could use this survival mechanism and make people do things that, you know, against their will, basically. And so what they do is they use fear as this primary survival mechanism that's installed in everybody, and they give you false information that's putting you in fear all the time so that you'll take these actions that they're predicting. And basically it's taking advantage of people who don't understand what's going on and taking advantage of their lack of ability to, you know, cognitively understand what's going on and go through a process of learning to dissolve that fear. They're taking that fear, they're bolstering and feeding that fear and giving it momentum, and then using it against people to get them to either buy into gold or buy into end of the world, you know, type of supplies and all of these other things that go on.
Where does the fear tie in with our monetary system? And how far back does this go in history?
Well, the economy is driven by consumerism. Consumerism is driven by sales. And sales predominantly are driven by fear. I have to make you in fear that you don't have what you need right now and that what I'm selling you is what you need. That was your job as a salesperson. If it's Sarbanes-Oxley, you're at risk of being audited by these, you know, the SEC or the FBI or whatever. If you had this software, it would satiate that concern. The whole point of advertising, as we're taught, is to make whoever you're advertising to feel insecure and incomplete with what they have. They connect your emotion to your pocketbook, and that pocketbook idea of whatever's on the screen, that's what my pocketbook's going to connect to next. So they play a snappy Beatles song, then you're like, I like that, it makes me feel good, I remember hearing that song long ago, it made me happy. Then you're like, I want to buy that because it's associated, it's called transfer, and boom, they've got you. So at the end of the day, the economy is based on fear because fear drives sales, and sales drives consumerism, and that's how the economy gets rich, which is why they don't give a sales degree in college, because when you understand what is necessary to do the job of sales, they give this out in certain mystery schools, they'll give it to you in certain corporations. I happened to learn to run my own business while I was in college and acquired the, you know, the skills through reading books. And so the information is either gotten, like I did, through running your own business and doing a bunch of research, or you can go into one of these organizations that teaches this, but it's not an educational organization. It's more of a fraternal organization that would want to teach you the art of persuasive speech and rhetoric, because it's through rhetoric and persuasive speech that the elite actually govern the rest of the people. It's through the use of effective arguments, even though if they're full of fallacies, if those fallacies are believed by the people, it's effective rhetoric. And this type of misuse of effective rhetoric for the reasons of political gain or personal profit is called sophism. This problem's existed since the time of Plato, when Plato was talking about the sophists. This is where you get lawyers today with sophisticated arguments. They're arguing for money, not because it's the right thing to do or it's good for their country. They're getting paid. So when you're arguing for money, purely for money and not for right or wrong or morality or ethics or American ideas or whatnot, you run the risk of having people who are trained in, you know, highly trained in the effective use of persuasive speech and rhetoric in the form of lawyers, politicians, and salesmen out there doing these things without people, you know, really understanding what's going on. And there's a lot of really advanced techniques that can be put into that that are used by the politicians, that are definitely used by lawyers in lines of questioning and whatnot. So by becoming aware of these things, by, you know, through my experience as a salesperson, and then realizing they don't want people to understand how to speak effectively, how to speak persuasively. And let's look at, you know, advertising. Advertising and commerce and sales and all this is using fear to make people give their money for a product that is claimed to satisfy their perceived need. And how it works is advertising in the past would appeal to your intellect. This product can serve you in this ways. It has these characters, these facets, these benefits. Now, you know, so in the past, it was intellect over emotion. They weren't using emotion to sell things. And now what they've done is they've put emotion at the top, intellect at the bottom. It's not so specific about how this product could empower you or make your life better. It's more about connecting the emotion to the product, and that emotion connects to your buying and your consumer activities. What they've effectively done is taking grown people, mature adults, and taking their intellect and have that subverted by emotional content that makes you feel insecure or inadequate with what you already have so that you'll buy the product that's being advertised. This use of fear is the very basis of the price of gold. The price of gold is predicated on uncertainty. So the more you can make the public fear, the more you can put them in anxiety, the more you can confuse them, all these things are good for the price of gold. So my question to you is, what is the sales pitch for gold? It's the use of fear to give you anxiety about your climate, your environment, all these things, and that makes the uncertainty go up.
Gold is starting to go up. Gold is hovering around $1,000 an ounce. Any way to protect yourself?
Well, you invest in things that are friendly to inflation.
Gold.
Gold.
Gold. Gold. Gold. Gold.
I love gold. I wonder why gold is going up right now.
The gold rush of 2009.
If you're worried about worrying, you go out and you buy gold.
It's kind of a nice little feedback loop. Glenn Beck is paid by Goldline to drum up interest in gold, which increases in value during times of fear, an emotion reinforced nightly on Fox by Glenn Beck.
If you look at 9/11, who were the people on Wall Street that were happy that day? Anyone invested in gold. Gold was skyrocketing. I know I've seen quotes of all sorts of stockbrokers and people in the financial markets in Wall Street, like, you know, praising the Lord because gold was going through the roof. Who cares? Because there's calamity outside, you know, and their pockets were getting rich. So they weren't involved in it. They were profiting from it.
I got to be honest with you. When the September 11th situation happened, I didn't know that. And I must say, and I want to say this because it's, I want to take it lightly. It's not a light situation. It's a devastating act. It was really a bad thing. It was one of the worst things I've seen in my lifetime, you know. But I will tell you, and every trader will tell you, who was not in that building and who was buying gold and who owned gold and silver, that when it happened, the first thing you thought about was, well, how much is gold up? The first thing that came to mind was, my God, gold must be exploding. Fortunately for us, all our clients were in gold. So when it went up, they all doubled their money. Everybody doubled their money. It was a blessing in disguise. Devastating, crushing, heart-shattering. But on a financial sense, for my clients that were in the market, they all made money.
Because there's calamity outside, you know, and their pockets were getting rich. So they weren't involved in it. They were profiting from it. And it's these people who use fear and then profit from the rest of us who are unwittingly participating in a stock market investment, 401k, retirement plan, you know, teachers' investment funds, all these different things, the firemen's funds, all these people with large pensions and retirements that are all set up and supposed to be guarded by these trusted people in the brokerage markets. Well, when you find out that it's all a scam, it's all a Ponzi scheme, and that when you discover that the people who find out about it last are the people who lose the most money, then you see the need for media in the fourth estate, and we've lost a mechanism that takes the whistleblower experience and evidence over here and actually gets it to the people over here in the public who are unwittingly invested in these frauds, who need it to protect their life savings and their nest eggs and their kids' future and their kids' education, all these things that they're concerned about, protect their own houses, right?
What is the causality of the complete failure of the media, and what's the solution to the information crisis?
Without the media mechanism in the middle to take this information from the whistleblowers and the evidence and get it to these people, this group of people who we call the citizens of the United States have lost their freedom. They've lost their ability to make informed decisions, to protect their assets, to protect their interests, and to look out for their future. They've lost the ability to pursue life, liberty, and happiness because all of that is being denied because someone's cutting off this information and not letting it flow freely. So what you have is, you know, you have to come to terms with what this situation means. And if doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result is the definition of insanity, then the definition for sanity would be learning. Learning is the opposite of insanity. So the way we get out of these insane problems is by doing some learning, putting your intellect back above your emotions. And not saying be emotion free, it's just put it in check. You don't let yourself make these emotional buying decisions based on Jim Cramer and his emotional presentation of it, because if he really had the facts and was really working in your best interest, he'd be a little bit more calm. He would sit still. He would actually try to present the facts coherently and give you some, here's the primary sources, here's why I think this.
I understand you want to make finance entertaining, but it's not a game. And I when I watch that, I can't tell you how angry that makes me. Because what it says to me is, you all know. But you all know what's going on. You know, you can draw a straight line from those shenanigans to the stuff that was being pulled at Bear and at AIG and all this derivative market stuff that is this weird Wall Street side bet.
John, don't you want guys like me who have been in it to show the shenanigans? What else can I do? I mean, last night's show...
I want desperately for that, but I feel like that's not what we're getting. What we're getting is, listen, you knew what the banks were doing, and yet we're touting it for months and months. The entire network was. And so now to pretend that this was some sort of crazy once-in-a-lifetime tsunami that nobody could have seen coming is disingenuous at best and criminal at worst.
My opinion's not that valuable. What I'm looking to do is present the evidence and show people, look, here's how they're doing X, Y, and Z. And that should have been done years ago. But now we're left with an autopsy of this situation. There are trillions of dollars missing. No one's quite sure what happened. There's no records. There's no oversight. There's no regulatory commission that's willing, ready, willing, and able to look into this. Our congressmen are all bought off by the corporate lobbyists. So it's really like there is no one left to tell but the American people. And it's we're all standing around and finding this out while the people who took the resources of our country have left the building.
So then the fear ties in directly to the monetary system and inflation by way of persuasive rhetoric and propaganda, which is used to create anxiety, which is the triggering mechanism for people to purchase gold.
Well, the fear ties directly in with the monetary system in this element called gold. And with fear being tied directly to the price of gold, and with the increase of fear and uncertainty and anxiety, propelling gold to what, $1,300 an ounce right now. I think around 9/11 it was maybe $300 an ounce or less. So now it's more than tripled in price as a result of the fear. So that's where the fear connects directly into the economy, in addition to the fear aspect that's used to drive sales. For instance, Legato used to sell its email extender software with a marketing sheet that said, and this is October of 2001, as the bombs fall in Afghanistan, you know, blah, 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 you need to protect your data infrastructure. Now, in today's, you know, terrorist world, whole sites, whole buildings can disappear. So there's a need for data redundancy and off-site storage. And it was all being used by all these computer and technology companies as an artificial scare tactic to scare all these companies that would never need to worry about having data redundancy and off-site management and duplicity, and mirroring of all these different sites. These are unnecessary costs that were then again pushed on corporations in a post 9/11 world, in addition to the Sarbanes-Oxley regulations. So really, in this calamity, and everyone's confused, the few people who could see clearly were not using it to help corporations protect themselves and see clearly. They were using it to take advantage and to steal trillions of dollars, which people are now starting to realize, but you're still not getting the answers you need and deserve. And it's the same thing as 9/11. The families are not getting the answers they need and deserve because in all cases, there's no one left to investigate. There's no regulatory agency or authority that still has its integrity and the ability to actually, you know, collect the evidence, hold trials, and prosecute people that have done this. So this is where we have to begin. The crimes have gone on. The evidence is there. They're still in progress. And there's no proverbial police to call.
So tell me, what needs to be done to introduce stability to our economy? Real stability. Should we begin by understanding the history of money itself?
Well, how can we understand our personal economy or the nation's economy when the economists provided to us do not have the history of money in mind, and they're not trained in any sort of history of money? So how can people who have no insight as to case histories of different civilizations and how money has evolved over time, if they're not given that information, and they're just given, hey, here's Adam Smith, and capitalism's controlled by a black hand and an artificially contrived shortage, go about your business and bullshit the country, then you've got guys from like Jim Cramer, who went to Harvard with Elliot Spitzer and these other characters, and they're all playing a Ponzi scheme on the rest of us who, you know, once accountants are ripping off Enron and these other smart people, you know, it's like Joe Rogan says, that's it, that's far out intellectual stuff. If they can rip off accountants, they can definitely rip you off. when they can do it beyond the scrutiny of even the honest people inside of the FBI and the SEC, because at the end of the day, it's not all the people. They don't need all the people at the SEC or the FBI or any of these other agencies to be involved. They just need key people who are in the top of the structure to make sure that the guys that are doing their job and the women that are doing their job on the bottom line or on the front lines aren't getting any progress. The information won't go up. Nobody will do anything about it. They're frustrated, and they end up going off and doing other jobs. I know the one IRS agent who was in Aaron Russo's America, Freedom, and Fascism, who was there and was shown that there is no IRS tax code and people shouldn't be, you know, paying taxes, and she quit her job because she found out it's all a scheme. She's now in jail for that. Sherry Jackson, exactly. For, you know, and so it's, she's not in jail because she broke the law. She's in jail because she found out the whole thing's a, you know, it's a scheme, and she was trying to tell people and inform people and get people to save their own lives, because nobody's going to come around and save your life for you. I'm sorry to, you know, there was many a day that I wished that the person I was writing to would say, yeah, let me just publish this stuff and just get the facts out there or whatever. And it doesn't happen. And there's a reason it doesn't happen. It has to do with the almighty dollar. And that dollar sign that Ayn Rand uses in Atlas Shrugged, which is the sign of all the people that are, you know, participating in that plan. They wear a dollar sign on their lapels. And so when you understand the history of the dollar sign coming from the alchemist Cagliostro and all the occult nature of the economy and the creating of something out of nothing, which is what international bankers do, I mean, there is just so much area there that the oversight that needs to happen, it needs to, you know, Stephen Zarlinga from the American Monetary Institute wrote this book called The Lost Science of Money, and part of the book is something called the American Monetary Act. Part of the plan is that Congress would issue its own money. So it would no longer be owned by the Federal Reserve, which is neither federal nor reserve. So once the nation has its own money supply back under control of Congress as it's mandated in the Constitution, and once interest on any loans made is not being paid out of the country, then America is back on the right track. But as long as we do not understand that in the past, under Aristotle, money was created as law, and today it's created as debt. Back in the day, you know, a Congress or a republic or someone representing the people can create this law and say what money is. Today, when money is created as debt, who creates the debts? The bankers. So if the bankers are creating the debts and that creates the money, then that puts international bankers in control of our country, which means they have unlimited supplies of money to buy off every press agency and anybody that they need to, because if they don't buy them off, then they lose their career. And it's pretty, you know, not very many people are willing to take that leap knowingly and say, yeah, let me just sacrifice my career here, drop the guillotine on it, because everything I've ever worked for and everything I've ever earned, oh, it's not really worth anything. I won't mind losing that. I'll just sit, you know, and take it.
So how much did this whole lesson cost you?
It cost me everything that I had ever earned.
So then what do you do now for a living?
I'm currently the editor of Tragedy and Hope magazine, which is a subscription service that researches, organizes, and presents information to our audience to help them find life, liberty, and happiness through a process of critical thinking, which means you're always going to get what you expect because you've thought critically about it.
And what does that experience result in?
It results in you subscribing to a higher awareness, but ultimately it brings more meaning to your life. Things are a lot more fun because when you understand things, you're not left out of it. You're not left in anxiety. It reduces your fear. But this is all a process of learning, which is the primary function of Tragedy and Hope. It's to inspire learning quarter by quarter as we roll out the magazine and as we have other resources to help you organize information, communicate with your peers, reference other pieces of information that have already been dug up, and facilities and tools to help you actually go from the step of being an observer to a researcher, to a participant, to someone who's sharing meaningful information. If you've had something similar happen, you would need to do likewise, because Lowell Bergman's still not going to publish that which he can't publish.
Do you have any closing thoughts for the audience?
So if this lack of understanding that has proliferated and precipitated upon our world over the past couple years is an indicator of a necessary change that has to take place, we need to recognize that change is not tradition, change is not the status quo, change demands action, and that the actions we need to take as Americans are bring some checks and balances to bear on these unregulated situations and start to at least place a tourniquet on these gashes that have been made in our economy by way of Obama's team, Bush's team of administrators. These guys all work together, right hand, left hand. They have the same torso. Doesn't matter if it's a Republican or a Democrat. Republicans borrow money, Democrats tax you. They're still doing the same thing, serving the same agenda. It makes no difference. It's all for a goal that is not in the best interest of the American people. And the people who are doing it are not doing it in the best interest of America because they have allegiances to organizations which supersede the ideas of nationality. Support independent media or you will lose your independence. And that's not fear, that's just the facts. And if we don't like the facts, then let's do some learning together and figure out where things really are. If you don't agree with what I'm saying, I'm not expecting you to believe me. I'm expecting you to look for yourself, find the facts that are out there, have discussions with people, and come to a higher understanding. And that's what the whole dialogue is about.
Would you like to know more?
Without asking questions, one can never hope to understand.